Dr. Emily Mitchell, thank you very much for joining me today in this podcast. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's lovely to be here.
So I'd like to start with a sort of overview of the clock of our planet. And during your talk at the Cambridge Initiative for Planetary Science and Life in the Universe, you spoke about four major transitions. You said there are four major transitions in our planet: life, oxygenation, and then transition from monocellular to multicellular, and then colonization of land. So we're going to talk about the first three transitions today. So paleontologists and geologists came up with this diagram.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me a little bit about this? How did they come up with this diagram?
So this is demonstrating the, I guess, the different time periods of Earth's history. So you start with the formation at about 4.6 billion years ago in the Hadean, and then the Archean, so 4 billion to about 2.5. And so it's pretty much the Archean time period where you have life, but it's very, very simple microbial. And then around 2.4, 2.5 is when you get oxygenation of the planet. There's a stepwise jump in the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere due to cyanobacteria. And that carries on pretty much. Oh, you've missed out the Ediacaran period.
It's hidden there. But how did they come? I understood that they came up with this kind of subdivision based on the rocks.
Yes, yeah. So how people decide to break up the different time periods is very much based on the rocks. And what they're looking for is signals that can be identified all over the world in all different places. So you can have a very important sequence of rocks, but if it's only found on one place on Earth, it's not very useful for tying things together. And so, this sequence of the different time periods has been identified long before we could date the rocks, for example, using kind of radioactive isotopes. And so, for example, the really big one is at 541 between the Protozoic and the Phanerozoic is the Cambrian time period. And that's when we start to see a lot of fossils throughout the world, things like trilobites. But this particular boundary is delineated by trace fossils, so a particular sort of trails that are made by mobile animals. And because you can find them all over the world, you know when you start to see this particular sort of trace fossil that you've reached the Cambrian.
Oh, okay. Now let's talk about the first period. So solar system forms, planet Earth starting accreting from all this debris that is available, and then we get the Earth around 4.55 billion years ago, and we have kind of hellish conditions. Then the moon forms. What kind of situation did we have there?
So the heavy late bombardment is something I don't know a huge amount about, but it would have been impossible, I would have thought, for life to form at this point because it's just so inhospitable. You've just got this constant rain of meteorites hitting the Earth.
So when do we get life?
So there's a big debate about when exactly life starts. But we've got pretty good ideas of... And it's very... Because it's such an important thing to understand, there's lots of debate. And so you get structures potentially at kind of 4.1, 4.2 billion years, which might be life, but those are a bit controversial.
So I was reading this paper and they talk about they found these microfossils and they dated them between 3.8 and 4.3. So that's something in between the Hadean eon and the Archean eon. So we're not sure. But one thing I want to ask you about this is that why do they talk about putative records, contested results? We are not sure. Why they're not sure?
Well, it's better to be realistic about your estimates. So you can find things at 4 billion, which if you found them today or, 60 million years ago, you could be pretty sure that it was life because there's a lot of life like that. But when you're looking at the oldest possible thing, you need to be kind of orders of magnitude more sure. And you need to be more careful at ruling out possible kind of abiotic causes.
How frequent are these fossils? How difficult is it to find them in our planet?
So, there are microfossils throughout all of Earth's history almost. Definitely from 3.2 billion years, you get tiny, tiny little microfossils that you can get by dissolving rock and the little fossils fall out. And they are... they're not super rare at that sort of age. And then as you get more frequent, so in the Phanerozoic in the last 540 million years, you get a lot of them. You get a lot of...
The Phanerozoic is where?
Is from 541, so the start of the Cambrian, forward. So the Paleozoic, Mesozoic and Cenozoic are all subsets of the Phanerozoic.
But the ones in the Hadean, they're more rare than...
I wouldn't want to say there are any definite microfossils in the Hadean, but we do get them in the Archean, and we do get a really nice actual fossil record in the Proterozoic. So in the Proterozoic, we can see the kind of evolution of life pretty well.
Now, the reason why I was asking you is because if we do find similar rocks on Mars, how difficult is it going to be to identify these microfossils in case they are there? And so what sort of challenges are we going to face?
So when we're looking at microfossils on Mars, there has to be very specific sort of preservation in order to be able to get the sort of microfossils that are so commonly found in the Proterozoic. And we have to be a lot more careful about how we interpret possible microfossils. So there are a lot of geobiologists and paleontologists that are looking at kind of slightly different ways and maybe less usual ways that we can preserve microfossils. But again, we need to be orders of magnitude more sure if we're looking at more Mars than we do here on Earth.
How do they get preserved? These microorganisms, how do they get fossilized?
So there are a few different ways. In the Archean, you get very large actual structures called stromatolites, which are the result of microbes processing the sediment and building up sedimentary layers. And these you can see with the naked eye. And you get those at 3.5 billion. So we know that we have very well-established life at 3.5 billion. But these sorts of stromatolites are quite rare now. You only find them in Shark's Bay in Australia and in the Bahamas. But most of the microfossils are preserved, kind of within the rocks. In kind of as carbon, they're known as small carbonaceous fossils.
Okay.
Yeah, and you get them by dissolving the rocks in hydrofluoric acid.
And we don't have those sorts of capabilities on the Perseverance rover. We don't have any.
You don't want to be messing with hydrofluoric acid.
No.
But as samples return, again, you have to look for the right sorts of rocks. That could be preserving them. They have to, yes, because if they've gone through too much metamorphosis, for example, then the fossils will be destroyed.
Okay, I want to ask you a question about Luca, who is not our friend, but is the last universal common ancestor. I don't know. Luca. Okay.
Luca.
Right, so there is this paper, and they set this Luca at around 3.9 billion years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, how do we know that all life evolved from this Luca? Or this Luca is just a representative thing? How would you explain this Luca thing?
So how do I explain what it is? The kind of, yes, Luca being the last universal common ancestor of all life on Earth. So the idea is that when you're talking about, say, prebiotic chemistry, you have things like amino acids. Amino acids are found outside the Earth, for example, but they don't actually come together to make a living organism. And so Luca is the first, the last common ancestor to life as we know it. So
do we know if life emerged in multiple locations at different periods of time, or we have no idea?
We can't be 100% sure, but it's quite likely that there's only one form of life when we started, yes.
And the other is it possible that maybe life is still emerging today, that we might be able to observe abiogenesis, and things like this thing? Or is there anyone doing, are you aware of anyone doing any studies like that?
I think the thing is that life is everywhere now, and life is very good at adapting the world to make it more hospitable for the life. And so it's very hard to imagine a situation where there was a kind of, an isolated enough atmosphere.
Without life.
Without life that could then potentially be a cradle for new life. Apart from in people's labs, of course.
Yeah. But that's another story.
Yes, indeed.
Now, it just came across this new word for me, taphonomy.
Yes, taphonomy.
Which is the study of decomposition and fossilization of biological materials. And there was this interesting article on the Science website that I was reading the other day, where basically they mentioned that paleontologists claim that proteins might survive for more than 100 million years, which is amazing. So they say that animals, when they die, these proteins degrade into hard polymers, and then they can use a Raman spectroscopy to reconstruct the degraded polymers into the original ones. And they even claim that they had identified a protein residues 500 million years old in Canada, which is huge. 500 million years, you can reconstruct proteins, huge. So my question is, if we find Hadean fossils or very old fossils, do you think is there any chance? Maybe it's a stupid question, but do you think there is any chance we might be able to use these forensic techniques to work out how life emerged from prebiotic chemistry? Oh, that's completely insane.
I think it's easy to kind of forget the timescales involved. So one analogy I quite like is that if we kind of think of our arms and life, kind of Earth formed around about there, and then life formed around the armpit, we only actually start getting animals right towards the end and humans right at the tips. So there's a long, you know, long, long period of time. So 500 million years sounds like a long time, but it's not really in comparison to the 4.5 billion years we've been around. Okay. But having said that, we did get some incredible biomarkers from around 550 million years ago that some colleagues found in Russia, which were looking at an Ediacaran fossil called Dickinsonia. And they compared they're essentially chemical fossils to different sorts of steriles, to bacteria and fungi and things that you'd find in animals, and found that they're most consistent with animals.
Okay.
So they're not the protein level, but it's molecular fossils, yeah.
There's no way you can get fossilized the DNA, right?
Well, how do you define fossilized? I mean, 10,000 years ago, Ice Age. Can do. So
yeah. It's if it's frozen, right? Yeah.
Mm. You need very, very special preservation.
But you need the water. Otherwise, it's...
You need different sorts of preservation conditions for different sorts of fossilization processes. There are lots of different ways that fossils can be preserved and organisms can be preserved.
Okay, so next thing I wanted to ask you, because you're an expert in this field, is can we explain what's Darwinian evolution and what are the key concepts in Darwinian evolution?
So the key concepts of Darwinian evolution is the idea of natural selection. So this is the idea that over time, kind of as a result of sexual reproduction, you get different sorts of DNA, so different sorts of genetics coming out within a population. And the natural environment, which is the physical environment, but also the interactions between different living organisms, will create different pressures. And so different animals will do better in slightly different situations. And if you give enough time, then you have different species forming. So you might have species that are particularly good at living at the base of a tree versus in a tree. And they'll develop different sorts of traits, such as leg length, in order to adapt to their to specialize to a particular environment.
NASA defines life as a self-sustaining chemical system capable of Darwinian evolution.
Yep.
And then if you go and check the definition of evolution from Wikipedia, they say, evolution is a change in the heritable characteristics of biological populations, so life over successive generations. So it looks like the definition of life uses evolution and the definition of evolution uses life.
Yes.
Which is a circular definition. Do you have a better definition of life?
Well, the NASA, no. A lot of time and effort went into coming up with this. yes.
Okay. So do you think we could remove life from the definition of evolution? Can we have evolution without life?
A lot of people think about that. And you have kind of computer systems or computer code where you program in basic characteristics, and then your kind of electronic life, if you will, develops kind of and evolves in a certain extent in new ways. But it's not life.
Yeah, so you can have this sort of thing, which is genetic algorithms. Which it's an example. There's a 3D function, x and y, and z is the altitude. You start from wherever you are, then you basically do natural selection, and then until you get to the local minimum that you're trying to to reach. So I think I was thinking in terms of, I told you before, but this concept, so this the concept of evolution and also self-preservation, because if you don't have self-preservation, you're gonna die. You starve. Yeah. You don't want to preserve yourself, so you die. So this is all information. These are rules. Are you confident that one day we will be able to work out these rules from first principles
of self-preservation?
Yes.
What and why life has this?
Yes.
Well, I think a lot of it is about the extent to which we're consciously trying to preserve ourselves. So as humans and a lot of animals, it's a very conscious decision. We know we need to do things, but a lot of simpler life, like cyanobacteria, they have a sense of self-preservation, but there's no sense in which it's conscious. So will we understand where that's coming from? I'm not sure we will, but we can study aspects of kind of social animals, for example, to get ideas of preservation and how different groups of animals will have different senses of what constitutes the self. So not all animals will prioritize them as an individual. A lot will prioritize the community or the herd.
Okay.
Yeah, so you have elephants, for example, female elephants that will never reproduce, but they'll help to look after their sister's offspring, for example, or ants that will, you know, literally sacrifice themselves to save their community.
And is that the reason why we got from monocellular to multicellular?
Ah, that's a really difficult question. So it's fascinating, the evolution of multicellularity, because it's actually relatively common. It's evolved, well, depending on your definitions, kind of 8 to 16 different times. But a lot of the multicellularity is microbial. So we actually get microbial multicellularity a long time before we get large multicellular animals. So it's about a billion years ago we see, in, preserved as microfossils, multicellular red algae, we think they are.
How do you differentiate from aggregates of monocellular organisms and actual multicellular organisms?
It can be quite hard, especially when you're going back very deep in time. But with these particular multicellular, you can see the way they branch, and you can see the way that the different cells are slightly different, and they're kind of contributing.
Oh, okay. The next period in this clock is the Archean period that goes from 4 billion to 2.5.
Yep.
And basically here we have the appearance of cyanobacteria, right?
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you could tell me, what was the effect of cyanobacteria on our planet? How did they modify things?
So this is one of the really big kind of ecological transitions in the history of life on Earth. We have the emergence of life, say, around 4 billion. And then we have a few different sorts of photosynthesizers. So there are many different ways you can photosynthesize, but the really important one was the oxygenetic photosynthesis. And that's what that led to. It's about 2.4 billion is a buildup in the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere. So you see a stepwise jump in the amount of oxygen, which totally transforms the entire biosphere.
So that starts, when does it start or when does it end? Well, it keeps going, right?
Well, so in terms of oxygen levels, we have relatively low levels during the Archean.
Okay.
And at some point towards the end of that, you get cyanobacteria producing oxygen. And then, but you see a jump at, again, around, I think it's 2.1 to 2.4 billion years, you see a jump in oxygen levels. It can be hard to date things precisely when we're going so far back in time.
And this is an illustration that shows the stromatolites,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, beautiful. Yes, yeah. Very nice. Yeah.
And you said they are found in Australia. I think
yes.
I have a video here.
Yes, yeah.
From a David Attenborough documentary.
Yes, no, it's amazing. You can go now and snorkel with the stromatolites.
Okay.
Yes. I did that a few years ago. It was incredible. It's really hypersaline water, which is why the stromatolites can form, because you don't get much fish or other life, because you need to have very calm conditions, because the building up of the microbial layers, if they're disturbed by fish or other animals moving or walking on it, they don't essentially get the opportunity to build up.
Do you know why they form these clusters?
The clumps? No, I don't.
That's curious to see that.
Yeah, but they do. They form these kind of individual clumps, and then sometimes they form almost like reefs, long reefs. and sometimes a, you know, quite large area. So there's a huge variety in different structures.
What information can we extract from these stromatolites?
I mean, the major thing is they're a proof of life, kind of going very far back. So they preserve, because they're the buildup of sediment formed by the microbes, they preserve very easily because sediment preserves a lot more easily than biotic stuff. So that's the main take.
So cyanobacteria now, I guess they stay on the surface of the water, right?
Well, a different sorts of cyanobacteria found all over. So you get it kind of within the water. You can get mats forming. You can get filaments forming. There's a lot of different sorts of species.
Do we know if they cover the entire surface of our planet? Do we have any idea about that?
I think that's what's thought kind of pre-animals, is that not so much stromatolites, but kind of microbial mats kind of covered the sea floor.
That's something I don't know if those are cyanobacteria, maybe that's phytoplankton.
It looks more like an algae.
But it's not cyanobacteria.
I don't think so, no.
Okay. I was wondering if, was there any predator eating this cyanobacteria?
No. So it depends. When we think of predators, we tend to think of animals eating other animals. So you do, I can't remember exactly. Sometime in the Proterozoic, you start to get little amoeba and protists. So you have micro-predation of prokaryotes, so kind of very kind of uncomplex cells, so that can kind of eat by consuming. So they kind of engulf their prey. But you don't. The first evidence you get of kind of macro predation is just before the Cambrian, around 541. You get little boreholes in some Ediacaran reef builders.
So those are the first Ediacaran animals that could move around.
No, well, so you get movement before you get predation. So yes. So the first kind of macroscopic complex fossils we see are found in the Ediacaran time period, which is just from 635 million years to 541. And the first ones you see are they're kind of immobile. They live detached to the seafloor, so they're a little bit like a soft coral or a sponge. Mm. And then you slowly start to see a build-up of trace fossils and evidence of mobility in the form of these trails.
Okay. So now the Proterozoic goes from 2.5 to 0.541.
Yep.
It's the end of the Ediacaran.
Yep.
And I'm interested in two events in the Neoproterozoic.
Yes.
One is when the Earth was completely frozen, and the other one is the Ediacaran.
Yes.
So let's talk about the cryogenian period that goes from 720 to 635, where we had a huge portion of our planet that was completely frozen or partially frozen. It's debated. But what I want to ask is that, first of all, how did we get there? And then what happened to the living beings there?
So how did we get there?
Yeah.
I'm afraid I'm not sure off the top of my head. I think you need to speak to the climate modellers. I think the idea is that you get to kind of a critical runaway point, so everything starts cooling and cooling and cooling. In terms of how did life survive, so we know life survives. We know that at the very least, things like cyanobacteria, amoeba, those sorts of things they lived before, they lived after. And in the water, and it's you know, life under the Antarctic ice shelves is very, very rich. So even if they're hundreds of thousands of kilometers away from open water, you still get microbial life, and you still get sponges and things actually living underneath the ice shelves.
You also get like bacteria and the worms living inside the ice.
So yes, so you can have frozen bacteria that then. When it melts, whether or not you could have the bacteria lasting for 30 million years, I think might be pushing it. But
like hibernating.
That's a very, very long time. You do get you can get pockets of meltwater essentially on top of the ice where life nowadays can persist. But again, it's very, very different timescales we're talking about. But as you say, we're not sure the extent to which they were properly snowball Earth versus partial.
But for sure, there was some disruption in the living organisms at that time. Okay. Now, the reason why I wanted to briefly touch on this is because what do you think would be the implications for life on Enceladus, for example, which is a moon of Saturn, which is it's got the ocean, we know. I mean,
I think it's really exciting. I think it'd be really, really great. And people are planning missions there and to Europa as well to look underneath and underneath the ice. And it's perfectly feasible that we could have life. I mean, I think with Europa, you do see actually evidence of ice moving. So there is that potential. Oh. I think it's Europa.
Okay.
So there's, it's definitely worth figuring out what's there and seeing if we can,
So we sent a probe. There was a probe Cassini that went to Enceladus, and they did also those kind of ejections of water, and I think they measured some carbon-based chemicals or something. Now, if the, now we're sending, as you said, we're sending probes. There is a breakthrough initiative, Breakthrough Enceladus initiative by Yuri Milner. They have crazy projects. One of them is like sending probes to Alpha Centauri.
Wow.
Which is interesting because it's privately funded.
Mm.
If there is life there, what kind of biosignatures can we expect to detect?
Well, it depends on the type of life, I think. And it's going to be very... So how we detect life on other planets very much depends how kind of developed the biosphere is. So... we've been talking a bit about the history of life on Earth, and so, you know, right around 4 billion, we don't even know if we did have life. If we did have life, how would we detect? It'd be very, very difficult to detect because it's low levels, and it's not the really key factor is life normally has a massive impact nowadays on the entire Earth, and so we've seen that kind of throughout the history of life on Earth with the evolution of cyanobacteria and seeing this rise in oxygen levels. And then again, when animals correlate to another rise in oxygen levels. And so the different sorts of biosignatures we might find, it's really hard to pull apart. And it depends on what sort of mechanisms we're using to detect. So with somewhere like the moons within the solar system, there is that potential to go and collect samples and potentially bring them back. As we're
I'm having trouble understanding right now. Please try a little later.
Who is this? Was it me or? So yeah, what were you saying?
Someone doesn't understand what I'm saying.
I don't know what was that.
I don't know what that was, but so what sort of biosignatures might we? I mean, the perfect one would be able to get a probe, go under the ice, collect lots of different samples, bring them back, and then analyze what's actually in the water. I think that's a bit of a pipe dream.
It's very thick.
Yeah, it's very, very thick. But, you know, potentially if there's water kind of coming out of the ice, we could get a sample from there. In terms of how we detect it within the atmosphere, that's, again, a different sort of thing to what we're dealing with here.
Yeah. So the next period after the cryogenic is the Ediacaran, which goes from 635 to 541. Now, before we get there, if the old planet was covered with ice, you get this kind of positive feedback loop.
Mm.
So the albedo is higher than when you don't have ice.
Yeah.
So it keeps reflecting the light away and it keeps getting cooler and cooler.
Mm.
Was there anything that disrupted this kind of snowball ice?
I mean, there must have been. There must have been.
For sure.
Because we're not there now, but yes. So we did have a series of kind of global, near-global glaciations. And then the last one, which wasn't a global glaciation, was at the Gasquets, where you had kind of ice down to potentially quite low latitudes of up to maybe 30 degrees. And then shortly after that, you start seeing very widespread complex fossils.
But we don't know what happened exactly.
No.
Okay. Do we have any evolutionary evidence from fossil records about the transition from monocellular to the Ediacaran biota?
So we've got the microfossil record is very, very good at kind of, I guess, documenting evolution throughout the Proterozoic. So we can see we start off at kind of, I guess, 2.4 or so with very simple spheres that they're called acrotarts. They're not particularly interesting. They're basically just balls. But then as you progress throughout the protozoa, you start to see what's known as eukaryotes evolve. So you go from having the simple prokaryotic cells to the eukaryotics. And so, which is kind of how we get animals, how we get plants, how we get fungi, the kind of really complex life is the eukaryotic. And we can see that in the fossil record. And then we can see the eukaryotes evolve. We can see the multicellular eukaryotes evolve. And then in the Ediacaran, we have a variety of different quite complex microfossils around about, 600 million years, a bit before, which are potentially, some people think they could be animal embryos. We see potential micro sponges as well.
Oh.
They're quite controversial, but we have these wonderful microfossils, but we, yes, the Ediacaran biota. we don't have jellyfish like that in the Ediacaran, but
do you think there is something wrong with this picture?
Yes. The biggest, so a lot of the Ediacaran macrofossils look like discs. They're just kind of circular. So for a long time, people thought they were jellyfish. And although we now do have one or two jellyfish fossils potentially in the Ediacaran, they're nowhere near as widespread as we first thought.
So this illustration is from that belief.
Yes,
Okay.
So it's quite common. But the kind of the background fronds you see, those are very nicely done. And we also do get algae.
How about the color?
We have no idea about the color.
There's no way we can
no.
get pigmentation.
Far, far too old to get pigmentation.
But in the depictions I saw from, I don't know, maybe some papers, even the documentary from David Attenborough, they depict them as white.
Well, white is a common one simply because they don't need... So this represents a community from somewhere like Australia or Russia from around 550. But the oldest of the Ediacaran macrofossils, there's some potential macrofossils at around 600 million, known as the Lantien biota. And those are mostly algal with potentially one or two cnidarians.
Okay.
But it's a single locality. And then at around 580, 572 or so, you start to see these a wider range of complex macrofossils. But these were found in very much deep water rocks, so well below the photic zone, which means that if they've never seen light and they don't know light, what colour would they be? Would they? And a lot of deep sea sponges, for example, are white, but not all of them. And the corals often are pinks and reds and things. So there's a lot of debate about what colours they
could
be.
Some of them are transparent.
And some of them are quite transparent, yes.
Yeah.
So there's a huge variety. So, jellyfish aside, these could quite easily be realistic colours, but we can't know.
You wrote this paper.
Yes.
Very interesting. You look at basically whether elongation in some of these animals might have been driven by competition for resources.
Yes, yes.
But then you concluded something else.
Yes, that's right. So in modern kind of seafork communities, so they're known as benthic communities.
Benthic means?
Like living on the seafloor. So you have pelagic communities, that's stuff that swims around, so things like sharks. And benthic is things like coral reefs. So in modern benthic communities, they're very, very competitive. So coral reefs, for example, they're all competing with each other for space. And in the deep sea, they're all competing with each other for food. So because there's not very much food in the deep sea. So the idea that was first suggested was that the reason Ediacaran organisms were tall and tall, it's up to 60 centimetres, although some of them are up to 2 metres long. So this is very big when you consider that 100 million years ago you just had microfossils. So the idea was that they grew tall in order to try and outcompete each other for food in the water column. And so it's rather like a rainforest. You have different sorts of species live at different layers.
Mm.
And so you've got the ones that are adapted to live right on the soil, and ones that are adapted for more of the mid layers, and ones that are adapted for the canopy layer. And it was thought that this applied to the Ediacaran organisms as well. So they evolved stems, for example, which, again, for the time was very complex, a brand new thing, in order to try and outcompete their neighbours. Because if the food's coming down from the top. If you can be a bit taller than all your neighbours, you're going to get the first lot of food. So that was what was thought was going on. But me and Dr. Charlotte Kensington wanted to actually kind of quantitatively assess this. And so what we did is we did two things. Firstly, it's like, how do you identify competition, which is very tricky? And then how do you measure the extent to which different species lived in different parts of the water column? And so it's with competition, it's relatively easy. So these Ediacaran fossils were preserved by a massive volcanic ash flow underwater. So it's rather like Pompeii. They were standing there wafting around and a big volcanic ash flow came and killed everything. And because they couldn't move around, they couldn't escape, and they're all killed. So you have essentially an entire community. And because they couldn't move around, their entire life history is encapsulated by the position and the size of them on the rock. So how they got there, so that's how they reproduce, and how they interacted with each other and their environment. And so you can identify competition because competition for resources looks like the spacing out of different species, different specimens of fossils. So one way to think, if you think of a deep sea community, they're very spaced out. And that's because they need a certain amount of water around them to get the food that volume of water provides. And if you have two corals really close together, there's not enough food for both of them. So one of them will die, and that leads to kind of spacing out of the points. So you can identify this sort of competition by analysing statistically the spatial positions of the fossils on the rock surface. And then in this paper, what we did is once we'd identified competition, we then compared the instances of competition to how they compare to the degree of stratification in the water column. So if you are getting big in order to avoid competing with each other, then that has predictions. What that means is if you've got two species that are occupying different parts of the water, they shouldn't compete, and they should compete if they occupy the same part of the water column. So we then compared the instances of competition to whether or not they occupy the same part of the water column, and we found a whole load of mess. You had species that occupied very different parts of the water column that were competing, and ones that were occupying the same ones that didn't compete.
Okay, this is counterintuitive.
Yes, exactly. Okay. It's very counterintuitive. And it's also counterintuitive because we were expecting that the ones with stems, so if you grow a stem, that's quite nice if you're trying to, for example, you're trying to get light. You want to get as high as possible, as quickly as possible, using the least energy to get to the light. And so we thought that's what the stems are for. They're trying to get to a new part of the water column. And so to get to the food. But what you found is actually stemmed organisms tended to overlap a lot with each other and occupy the same part of the water column. So stems were not for that reason. So then, of course, the question comes, what use is stems? Why were they large? And the only realized advantage we could find for being tall was in order to be able to disperse your offspring further. So that if you've got a very tall sponge or coral, it means that when you release your offspring into the water, they can travel much, much further than if you release them close to the substrate.
With the current.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So the other thing I want to ask you about is the Ediacaran biota. Is there any evidence of ongoing evolution from the record that we have? Do we see any transit? Because I guess these fossil records span across a wide range of millions of years.
Yes, yes. So we have about 30 million years of Ediacaran macrofossils, and we see a lot of different really important innovations. So the first things we get it's first evidence of animals, the first evidence of large body size, and then in the oldest of the rocks. And then as you get younger, you start to see a huge diversity in the number of species. So it's more than 10 times more species. And also you see a much wider range of body plans as well, and anatomies. And with this, you get different modes of life. So you get evidence of movement in the form of trails. So you see, and lots of different sorts of trails. So it's not just one or two, there's a lot of different ones. You see, kind of small little wiggles of very small animals moving around. But you see also kind of trails or footprints of larger organisms such as Dickinsonia, which I think was in one of the, the jellyfish diorama. And you see what you see is this amazing kind of trail where you see the kind of impression of the Dickinsonia as it moves across the substrate. And you can see the imprints of the Dickinsonia. And then the last one is the body fossil. And that's kind of in the opposite direction.
So how do we know that these things are animals?
So for a long time, actually, we didn't know. When I started working in the Ediacaran in 2008, it was commonly thought that, well, I should go back a bit. The body plans that we see of Ediacaran fossils are pretty much unique to the Ediacaran. We don't see many things like them alive today or elsewhere in the fossil record. And they were so unique that pretty much every sort of different group of living things been suggested. So kind of different sorts of bacterial colonies, lichen, fungi. And indeed, when I started my PhD, it was thought that they were actually most likely to be an extinct kingdom. The idea is that life got large and complex, but ultimately failed and died out. But there are kind of increasingly more different lines of evidence to suggest that they were indeed the first animals. So I mentioned the chemical fossils, the biomarkers of the Dickinsonia, and that is a bit controversial, but it's one line of evidence that strongly suggested that Dickinsonia, at least these sorts of things, were animals. And the other line of evidence comes from Dr. Frankie Dunn, who's in Oxford, and she looked at how the Ediacaran organisms, including Dickinsonia and Chania, grew, and showed that they were consistent with an animal mode of development or mode of growth, but critically not anything else, so not fungi and not plants. And so you've got these multiple different lines of evidence that are kind of converging on this idea that they were animals.
How did they get anchored to the bottom of the ocean? Because, of course, I mean, if they're not anchored, they're going to drift away with the current.
Yes. Well, so it's thought that we mentioned microbial mats. So you have evidence of preserved microbial mats on the seafloor. So it's thought that these helped to kind of essentially make the substrate stronger. So it wasn't just, this looks quite a lot like sand. It wasn't just kind of normal beach sand. It was kind of strengthened with microbial mats, and the microbial mats helped to anchor these organisms to the seafloor.
Do you know what kind of food they had? What did they eat?
So they fed from the water column, and so it would have been different sorts of plankton. So phytoplankton, mainly things like cyanobacteria, heterotrophic bacteria, amoeba apparently, but also, because these are animals, they likely had a larvae form, so they would have reproduced, if you think, like coral spawning. And that could have been a food as well for them. So it's all these different sorts of plankton. But you also have things like dissolved organic carbon or particulate organic matter that come from the debris of kind of dead things, which they could have fed for. And organisms now, such as sponges, will feed on a variety of different things. So some living, such as the plankton, and some particulate organic matter or detritus of other kind of decaying remains of other things that have been kind of dissolved essentially into the water.
Okay, so the next one is the Fractofusus.
Yes, Fractofusus.
And I'm curious about why did they adopt? So these things, they have kind of fractal growth thing.
Yes, they're thought to be fractal branching.
Why? Do we know why? Can we speculate?
Well, we can speculate why. So it's thought that they were doing this to maximize the surface area. And so there are many ways you could do that. So plants do it in order to maximize the amount of light they get. And you get corals and sponges doing it to maximize the amount of water that they're in contact with so that they can feed with.
And you wrote a paper where you discussed how these Fractofusus reproduce.
Yes, yeah.
And I think that's exemplified in this illustration.
Yes, that's correct, yep.
How did it work? How does it work?
So this was using the spatial patterns of the Fractofusus on the surface. Okay. So for this paper, we analysed three different communities, each that had over 1,000 specimens in. So this is a lot of data, right? And bearing in mind, these are all soft-bodied kind of molds of where the organisms used to live. So it's really exceptional preservation. And so by looking at the spatial pattern, you can determine what the underlying processes were that resulted there. But what's really useful is that there's this huge bank of models that was developed for forest ecology that that kind of determines when you see certain sorts of spatial patterns what the underlying process is. So, for example, if you have a tree that seeds and then the seeds grow up around them, that has a particular sort of pattern. And you can distinguish between a dispersal or reproductive pattern to an environmental pattern. They have different sorts of spatial patterns. So if you think of a tree reproducing, that will have a different sort of spatial pattern to a tree that's on a patch of really nice soil.
Hmm.
And so you can use, by measuring out all the points of the fractifusus and then comparing the observed spatial distributions to different reproductive models and environmental models, you can determine what's causing the patterns. And so what we found for fractifusus was really, really interesting. So we had three generations of the fractifusus, the kind of big ones, the grandparents, the parents, and then the babies.
tell me, I'm going to open the paper because I think I have your paper here.
Yes.
Yes. The picture.
Yeah.
This one, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes, and so you can see this very clearly. You have the large ones, the medium ones, and the small ones. And so what we found is when we looked at the spatial patterns of the different sizes, they were different. So the largest ones were randomly distributed around the surface. Then the medium ones had a single reproductive cluster. And then the smallest ones had, you could see two levels of clustering or aggregation. And so what we found is the small ones clustered around the medium ones and the medium ones around the large ones. And so this is telling us that we've got these essentially colonization event and then two generations of reproduction. But then the key question is, well, how were they reproducing? And so, you know, these fractifuses, you don't see them really anywhere else. I mean, they're only around for, you know, 10, 15 million years at the most. Mm-hmm. They're very short-lived. So we really want to understand anything we can about the biology to try and pin down what exactly they were. And so we then started thinking about, well, how do modern immobile benthic organisms reproduce? And so there are three different ways. So you can, things like sponges and corals can reproduce by fragmenting or budding, so little bits of them break off and then germinate elsewhere.
Mm.
You can reproduce like coral spawn, so you release a lot of propagules into the water. Or you can reproduce using stolon or runners, so like strawberry plants or spider plants, producing little kind of clones.
Ah, okay.
And so the question is then, how would you distinguish these in the fossil record? So the first one of budding and fragments, if you had most of them being reproduced this way, then the really small ones would look like little fragments or broken off bits. They wouldn't look like small versions of the big ones. So I have mapped out about 8,000 fractifusus now.
8,000.
Yeah, and there are some bits that are broken and fragmented, but the vast majority of the little ones look like little baby versions of the big ones. Mm. So we know that they weren't reproducing using fragments or buds. So then we start thinking about, well, if you're releasing your propagules into the water, what does that look like? And so if something's waterborne, it's far more likely to go downstream with the current than it is to go either side. And so it also will go further. So that has two effects. One is that your kind of, I guess, reproductive clusters or aggregations will be much bigger because they'll be carried by the current. And also they will be oval because you're far more likely to get the babies downstream of the parent than you are either side or behind.
Yeah.
And so what you can then do is look at how the different size classes of the fractifuses are behaving. And what you find is that the largest ones are very directional. They're far more likely to be found, four times more likely to be found downstream of each other than they are either side, which shows that they were very much brought in on the current.
Huh?
But then with the medium and small ones, you don't get that. There's very small amount of fluctuation in terms of directionality. They're equally likely to be either side and back and forth. You also have very, very small clusters. So if the fractifuses were releasing into the water, the clusters would be bigger than what we see, which is why we concluded that these were reproducing via stolon or runs. But what's really, really cool, so I have a maths background. This is a really nice application of mathematics to the fossil record and saying this is how we think they reproduced. So 5 years after this paper came out, two of my colleagues, Dr. Alex Liu and Dr. Frankie Dunn, published a paper which had preserved, stolen or filaments in the fourth record attached to...
One of those lines.
Yes, yeah, attached to the different Ediacaran organisms, yeah, for five different species. So we had kind of physical proof that the maths and the predictions made by the maths was correct.
Oh, okay. Before you said that this Ediacaran biota doesn't look like anything that we have now, are we sure? I mean, are we sure that there is nothing that evolved from those?
So that's two different things.
Yeah,
they look very they look very different. There are some similarities. So for example, we have organisms that are bilaterally symmetric, like we are. We have some that potentially could be very kind of early mollusks, so things related to things like snails, potentially. And we have some which are thought to be stalked jellyfish.
Hmm.
And so we do have some similarities, but the vast majority looked very, very different. So we absolutely, there were kind of animals were around, and so there kind of our descendants started, or our kind of ancestors would have started in the Ediacaran, but they didn't survive outside the Ediacaran, these particular species.
Okay, so this species got extinct. Do we know why? Do we know what's the reason?
No, we don't know why. And so there's a really unfortunate kind of block of time missing from the fossil record just after the end of the Ediacaran at the start of the Cambrian. So just because kind of a species goes extinct doesn't mean there was a mass extinction.
Yeah.
So you get a turnover of species through time, and it's not terribly clear what's going on at the end of the Ediacaran, whether there was a big extinction. Common idea, or popular idea for a long time, was the idea that, you know, most of the Ediacarans were very attached to the microbial mats. They kind of they needed them in order to cement themselves.
Mm.
A lot of the ones kind of lived underneath it, potentially, or around it. And then but the thing is, once you got animals that could burrow and started digging up the microbial mat, the microbial mats disappear and everything dies. We now know that that's not really likely to be correct, because we actually see a big overlap between animals that could burrow horizontally and the existence of the soft-bodied Ediacaran organisms.
This is from
in Australia. Yes, yes.
But I don't know if it's showing here, but I was reading somewhere that at the end of the Ediacaran period, there is some sort of layer, a black layer, some mat, black mat or something.
Black mat.
I mean, indicating like low levels of oxygen, something like that.
That doesn't ring any bells. I mean, you do kind of at the end Cretaceous mass extinction have a very, very distinct layer, but you don't see the same sort of black layer at the, at the end of the Ediacaran. How you see the end of the Ediacaran and the start of the Cambrian is the burrows, is how you traditionally...
So because you see more...
Well, you see this kind of sequence, and you don't see any... You don't see anywhere near these particular sort of complex.
But we don't see that here.
So this is the start of the Ediacaran.
The bottom.
So the start of the Ediacaran is denoted by the end of the Marinoan glaciation. So you see the end of all the glacial rocks form.
Because when you have those glaciers, you get specific rocks from those ice.
Yes,
Okay. And that changes when everything melts.
Yes,
So you mentioned that you've been there, right?
Yes, yes.
So what did you do? What kind of field work did you do there?
So it was a field trip connected to a conference. So I haven't done any of my own work out in Australia.
Okay.
But I was visiting the wonderful, the Golden Spike and the wonderful fossil localities out there, and places like Nilpena, which is a wonderful, wonderful site, multiple, like 30-odd different fossil beds that's been worked on by Professor Mary Droser at Riverside and... Dr. Jim Gelling from the South Australia Museum. They've been working there for, must be coming up to 20 years now.
Okay.
Excavating it. Really, really incredible to visit it and see all their work.
Now, I'm curious about this map. Was Australia together with England and Newfoundland in Canada? Were they together back then?
No.
Is this map correct?
I think there's a more recent map.
There's a more recent one. Okay.
Yes. So the continents were in very different places. So the kind of key different groups or assemblages of Ediacaran fossils are known as the Avalon, which is from Canada and the UK. Then you have what's known as the White Sea, which is predominantly Russia and Australia. And then you've got Nama, which is from Namibia. And you have a lot of other sites as well, especially in China and in Brazil. but the three main assemblages still kind of remain. It's hard to slot in the new sites.
Okay.
And so the three different assemblages occupy different time periods approximately, and also different environments. So there were different places in the world at different times, yeah.
Okay, and so I was reading about a place close to Leicester.
Yes, Charnwood Forest.
These are some pictures from there.
Ah, Charnia. Yes.
And I was reading that the schoolboy discovered this thing.
Ah, yeah. So it's actually more interesting than that.
Okay.
So Roger Mason, a wonderful man, he's still a geologist now, works mainly in
Charnia.
Yes, okay. He's still alive. But actually, he was not the first one to find Charnia. It was discovered a year before by a schoolgirl called Tina Negus. But no one believed her. And so she told the teacher, and they're like, no, these rocks are Precambrian. You don't get fossils in Precambrian rocks.
Okay. Then
next year, Roger found Charnia with his friends and told, his father was a friend of a geologist at the University of Leicester, Trevor Ford. And so, yes, he is credited with the discovery.
Is this lady still alive?
Tina is still alive, yes.
Do you know her?
I've communicated with her.
Okay.
She's a very good artist. I've never met her in person, unfortunately. I've met Roger a few times. And Roger fully admits that Tina found them a year before, but people didn't believe her, unfortunately.
Yeah. That was in the end of the 50s, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes, yeah,
the 50s. And we found something similar in Canada as well. Similar to this,
yes. So they're a similar sort of age, and you get Charnias like this in Canada. Oh, and Fractifusus, yes.
That's a different one.
Yes, these wonderful fossils that Charlotte.
But we don't have any Charnia here. Oh, maybe here.
No. So you do on this surface. There are maybe four or five Charnias.
Okay.
But Charnia belongs to a group of organisms called rangiomorphs, and rangiomorphs are the group of organisms that have this fractal star branching.
Mm.
And so, yeah, the vast majority of these. So Fractifusus is a rangiomorph. Beothucus, which you can see there, is also a rangiomorph. So they have these branches of branches of branches. And so you get Charnia all over the world, actually, but you get them a lot in Newfoundland here at Mistaken Point.
So I guess most of your work is done here in Canada, right?
Yes. So.
And you sent me that picture. Hmm. We do lots of measurements. What was that thing?
Ah, so here we've got Mistaken Point, and it's actually a UNESCO World Heritage Site because of its importance to understanding the history of life on Earth. And we can see the reddish surface is the E surface, and the one behind it is D surface. And we've got actually some of G surface in the foreground. But the thing that you can see here is what's known as a LIDAR. And so LIDAR is a way to use lasers to measure very large areas. So this can go up to 300 meters. And so what we're doing here is we're LIDARing, focusing on the E and D surface, which we're capturing in order to capture the very, very large scale patterns of the rock surface. But it's not a very high resolution, so you can't make out the fossils when you're using LIDAR. So we use another sort of laser scanning to capture the details of the fossils themselves.
So you said the E and D.
Yes.
Do they belong to different periods?
It's very, very difficult to date these fossils. So the E surface is dated to 564 million years. And then you've got a few kilometres away, you've got another surface that's been dated to 572 million years. But yeah, they're within. I can't remember. I think they're within 1 million years of each other off the top of my head. But yeah, very, very similar in ages, yeah.
By the way, how do we know that these things were in the bottom of the ocean?
So because of the type of rock. So if you're in a shallow water, you have things like wave ripples, and you can see the effects of storms on the rock surfaces that are kind of preserved. Mm. So this is part of a 6 kilometer sequence of rocks where you only see the kind of rock structures that you find in deep water. So you see no evidence of any sort of shallow water at all. So that's why we know that they were deep water well below the photic zone. Because they were, very, very, very deep.
And they were brought up by plate tectonics.
Yes, and they're brought up by plate tectonics, yeah.
Has anyone thought about digging there?
So these are very, very protected
sites. No, I'm not talking about digging here. I'm talking about removing the soil there.
So that's that's a very difficult problem because you have to balance kind of all the different sorts of conservation needs. So these fossils absolutely need to stay where they are. There's no way practically to remove the whole surface, even if you want to, which you shouldn't want to. It should stay there.
To preserve it.
Well, you can't take... I mean, so, you know, that's 100 square metres.
Bring some heavy machinery and stuff.
Oh, don't. That's an awful thought. Awful, traumatic thought. But it's something that's being debated by the geoconservationists and the people who run the park, is to what extent the rockfall could potentially harm the surface. But the problem is, if you remove rocks, then more might come off. So you might actually make the erosion worse. So there's lots of quite difficult things to consider.
You put some grids to prevent those rocks from falling down. You know, those grids, those metal.
Yes, that is something that's been discussed. But then, what if that falls on the fossil surface? You know, this
the
is
net.
Brutal.
Okay. Yeah.
So this is a brutal, brutal coastline. So kind of in winter, you get 2 meters of snow, you get freeze and thaw, you get hurricanes coming through here. You know, it's not like England, which is rather gentle weather-wise normally. Anything that you put anywhere near the surfaces, you have to be 100% sure if it gets broken off by the wind. So we've been twice now doing fieldwork during hurricanes. So you're getting gusts of 100 miles an hour coming through to these surfaces. They're still standing. But if you put something near a surface that then was brought up, you know, it'd have to withstand those sorts of winds. But there's a scientific committee at Mistaken Point that is trying to work these things out.
And is there any plan to preserve these fossils, like to avoid erosion from wind or other things?
So there are different ways. So the entire of the e-surface has been cast by the Royal Ontario Museum. And so you can see this cast, the cast preservation. So a lot of my colleagues who will take casts, but you need scientific permits in order to work on these surfaces. And it's very, very restricted when it comes to casting, because you need to be careful. Personally, I use lasers, which don't harm the fossils in any way, and they just capture. So you've got a kind of digital preservation.
And then when you do casting, you might get even rubbish on the fossils, right? Some residuals of...
So now it is possible not to, that. And indeed, me and my colleagues have cast, not on the e-surface, but other Ediacaran sites. And it is absolutely possible to do it without damaging the fossils. But there's a slight risk factor, you know, kind of, especially with, I've always cast with a much more experienced colleague. So you need to have that experience. You need to know what you're doing. You need to know how to mix the cask material right, because if it goes wrong, it can go badly wrong.
Yeah. Do you want to show me those two?
So this is a cast of the Charnia from...
Okay.
Yes. And so we can see this is where attached to the sea floor. And then you've got, this is the main frond, it's called, that was up in the water column. And you see you've got your primary branches and then your secondary branches and your tertiary branches. And you won't be able to see across the table, but some places you can see four different levels of branching. And so this Charnia was the first fossil described from rocks that were known to be Precambrian. And this is actually kind of a huge deal. So we mentioned Darwin. In Darwin's Origin, he actually talks about the problem that is the fossil record, because the Cambrian fossil record was very well known. They saw kind of shells and trace fossils appear as if out of nowhere. And Darwin was really worried about this because to him, natural selection is a slow ongoing process. Yeah. So animals shouldn't appear out of nowhere. They should have a long, slow fuse. And that's what you get with these Ediacaran fossils. So they're kind of solving dolphins' problem. And so I brought another Rangimorph frond from the Discovery Geopark on Bonavista Peninsula. And then if you get the light right, you can see this really beautiful Cuma fronds. You can see really beautiful branching. So we can see the hold fast and the stem. And we've got a cask, because the fossil itself is in the field. And you can see the primary branches here. And then you can see the tiny little details of all the little sub branches there.
That's a fractal fusus.
This is a Cuma frons. So it's a Rangimorph fossil. So that's a group
so
of
organisms. Standing...
Yes, so they're standing upright. Yeah. So you know that they were standing upright because they're all kind of the holdfasts are all kind of and the fronds are all aligned in the same direction. Whereas something like fractifusus, On the seafloor, it was kind of pointing in lots of different directions. So it wasn't subject to the currents that killed them.
It's amazing because, yeah, depending on how you orient the thing, you see new features.
Yes, yeah, no. And it's one of the reasons why it's so difficult to collect that kind of data in the field. So during my PhD, I identified the fossils in the field and looked for them. But that was, well, firstly, if you want to then discuss what a specimen could be with your colleagues, you can't check or change anything. But it is very, very difficult. Whereas when you have the laser scans, you can control the lights. And so it's a lot easier. It's just so much easier to find things. And of course, casts do that too, because you can control the light. But it's a lot harder and very expensive to cast. So, for example, the E-surface, I think, cost maybe $250,000 to cast. I think it was. Whereas the laser scanning is much, much cheaper.
Yeah. And you got that, your barefoot. Oh,
yes. So this is a laser scan, and this is me in the Discovery Geopark, which is on a different peninsula in Newfoundland. And you can see the laser scanner I'm using. So I'm holding it above the surface, so it doesn't interact with the surface, doesn't penetrate the surface in any way. And you've got the mechanical arm, which is used to move around, and then it's attached to a tripod, which has rubber feet, mustn't hurt the fossils. And then to the computer. And so at somewhere like Mistaken Point, you're not allowed to wear shoes on the surface because they could trap stones underneath and then you kind of grind again.
Yeah.
So you have to wear little booties, which so we use neoprene booties, so they don't have any sort of structure, so they're very soft. In Discovery Geopark, I go barefoot here. Again, just to ensure that the surfaces and the fossils aren't
there. You wear a helmet.
So this particular site, I am wearing a helmet. Not all my colleagues do. I'm quite cautious. So I spent probably in total about 5 or 6 weeks scanning the surface. And there's a cliff and there's rockfall. I mean, maybe a dozen times over the course of 6 weeks. But if a rock falls and hits you, that's dangerous. So especially when you're kind of directly under the cliffs. But yeah.
That looks quite heavy. Where do you park and how far do you need to walk to get there? Because you cannot take your car up.
No. So some of the surfaces are about an hour away. The total amount of equipment that we need to take out is probably about 100 kilos in total, but some of it can be left over. So we need a petrol generator, for example. So that can be left out. The tripod can be left out. So what we tend to do the first day, we take out all the kit and then we'll leave some of it near the site. And then the electronic stuff we bring out. So it's about 70 kilos we bring out each day.
How many people?
It depends on the people. So a lot of the work I do with Dr. Charlotte Kensington, the two of us can manage it. We can carry quite a lot. Some,
two.
But about 30, 35 kilos each.
You carry a petrol generator with your hands.
So we put it in a box, attach it to. We've got these wonderful backpacks that you can attach. I mean, they're quite small. The petrol generator.
They make little tiny ones.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How many watts do you get from those?
I'm not sure. In terms of, I can't remember. I think it's 1,000. So you can't make coffee. So we had when the hurricane came through, we lost power last year, and we discovered it wasn't enough to make coffee. But it is enough to run this and the computer. You get about 8 hours on a tank.
8 hours.
So because it takes it takes a long time to walk out there, it takes a long time to set up. We can't work in the rain. You can't use this sort of equipment when it's raining or foggy. So when the weather's good, we tend to go out from dawn till dusk. And so we'll quite often spend 14 hours out. And so we'll need a couple of, some spare fuel. It's if you have 3 or 4 people, it's a lot easier to manage all the way.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. Yeah. You got a time lapse.
Here. Yes, yeah. So this is us laser scanning me and Charlotte. So this is about an hour, and you get about a meter squared done in an hour, and you can see that we pass the laser over the rock surface. And you get the accuracy through the mechanical arm that moves around.
And then you know what you scanned and what you didn't scan.
So that's the hard bit there. We have a map that we mark
otherwise,
down. Where we and so you need to overlap the scans.
Yeah, otherwise you forget where you've been.
Yeah. Yeah, you need to keep careful track of where you've been.
That's another video.
Yeah, so this is one of Charlotte's videos that she took of me scanning. So you can see holding it, you have to go very, very slowly, and you can just make out the blue line at the bottom. Mm. And so this is a laser, and so we're passing it over the fossil. And this is Charniodiscus. So you can see it's hold fast, and then it's got a stem, it's upright in the water column. You can see the line, the blue line passing over it. And this is amazing amount of resolution. We can see here the 3D digital
surface. You said
what's
the resolution of this
instrument? 40 microns you can get. So that's
40 microns.
Yes.
No yeah. way.
Yes way. But you need that level of resolution in order to be able to ID the species, to get those really beautiful kind of branches, to know what the species are. If you go to, say, 100 microns, so 0.1 of a millimetre, you can see the rough outline, but it can be quite hard to actually identify what sort of species it is. And you miss some of the smaller ones as well.
So that's the 3D that you get.
Yeah, the laser scan, yeah. And so you can see, again, we saw a photograph of this area. And you've got the kind of Charniodiscus, which are there. You've got a couple of Fratifuses, and you've got the Beothucus holotype, the Fratifuses down there.
In one of your papers, you were mentioning that sometimes these surfaces are not flat. There is some deformation, and then you need to flatten them out. How do you do
yes.
that?
Yes. So you can work out... So some of these surfaces, such as this E-surface, have been tectonically deformed. So as, you know, they're moving around with plate tectonics, and they got squashed together. So you might see some ripples, for example, on E-surface, and these aren't wave ripples, they're tectonic ripples. And you can tell because the circular discs of these fossils have been squashed. And so E-surface has a small amount of tectonic deformation, but some are very, very extreme. You get these circles that are very, very kind of oval shaped.
How do you unpack this is strain, right?
Yes, yeah. So I've experimented with a few different metrics. But actually, you only need to do quite a simple one, which is you take the length-width ratios of all the discs on the surface and then work out what's needed to turn them from being kind of ovals to circles. And then you apply that to the two different axes.
And how do you know they are circular?
Well, you see them across lots of different beds, and sometimes they're quite circular and sometimes they're not. But if you look at modern-day sponges and corals, their holdfast discs are circular.
Because if you didn't have that reference, you wouldn't be able to reconstruct.
So you still could reconstruct. It's quite interesting. So I've, like I said, I experimented with a lot with different metrics and how it changes things. And for my sort of work, which is population level of spatial points, it doesn't actually make a huge difference to the results. If you start to do more taxonomic, so describing different species, describing the details of the body plans, then it could potentially make a much bigger difference. And it's very noticeable when you're moving between different surfaces. You see the ones with the discs where they're very, very flat. You also see the fronds are kind of squished out. It's
Okay. I see. Mm. That's the review that I was mentioning before. And one of the things you mentioned is evolutionary convergence. And that's something you mentioned before, like when you spoke about comparing the statistics of... how things work in a forest with the fractofuzzles and so on. Yeah. But you showed me a very nice video, this one.
Oh, yes.
And so what can we learn by observing this kind of landscapes under the water? What can we learn about the Ediacara biota?
The wonderful... So this...
I'm just going to mute it because it's like a radio show.
Well, it's so exciting for the scientists when they found it. So this is part of an ongoing series of expeditions by NOAA to explore the deep sea in the Pacific Ocean. And they found this incredible community. And so these sponges, some of them are 5-6 feet tall. They're massive. And they're a whole new genre, the ones on the stalks. And you can see some of the brown ones where they've died. And so they're kind of... I think probably a pathogen or some kind of disease came through. Mm. You can see the corals.
And that's a coral there.
Yeah, so you can see. You've got the sponges, and then you've got some corals here. Yeah, another the big sponges, corals there. So these again, this is one of the modern communities that I've analysed, and it's maybe not terribly clear from this particular clip, but it covers this wonderful sponge and coral community covers about 100 square metres, and you can use all the forest ecology to work out how they're interacting with each other, how they're competing with each other, how they're interacting with the environment. So you have two different current regimes. So it's on a ridge. And the kind of the video comes up, and then on the ridge crest, it kind of goes very steep. So you have much faster currents, and you have a much higher you have twice the density of corals and sponges on the ridge crest compared to the ridge.
Hmm.
So you can actually start to analyze and see kind of how this all changes the interactions and the community dynamics. But this community, I got very excited when I first saw it, because it's like, this looks quite Ediacaran to me.
Yeah.
Strange forms. And you have it very diverse, very close together. A lot of deep sea sponges and corals, they are often just one or two different species, not many. They tend to be a lot more spaced out. But actually, this behaves very, very differently to the Ediacaran communities. So there's a lot of different interactions. You have a lot of competition at different sorts of spatial scales. You have facilitation between different taxa. So one of the corals makes it easier for another one to coexist nearby. You have a lot of interactions with the local substrate. So it's a very, very different sort of community in terms of its ecology compared to the Ediacarans. And it's something that I'm actively working on, is trying to get more modern data, especially from Antarctica, actually, in order to compare to the Ediacaran, because most modern communities are very different. But Antarctica is very, very different to everywhere else, because you have a lack of predators. For example, there are very few things that can crush shells, for example, and you tend to have a lot more suspension feeders like these that are living off plankton. So Antarctica seems to be the best modern analogue that we have.
How does it work if you want to plan an expedition for one of these places? You write a proposal?
This is a massive, massive kind of US government scheme.
Okay.
And the scientists I spoke to that were on this mission and then worked to identify all these corals, that they were wonderful. They were the ones who organised it. They did all the really difficult stuff of planning that. And I was just like, please, can I have your data?
Okay.
And they were like, yes, please do. It was wonderful. Really, really, really lovely.
Did you have a chance to go with them on the boat?
No, no, not at all. Not unfortunately. But I did get access to their data and their help with the different species, yeah.
Nice. Mm.
Yes.
So what's your next planned field work?
So I'm heading out with my students to Newfoundland this summer. We've got two field seasons planned. There's one where we're going to be doing the LIDARing, which is getting the large-scale bed forms of the surfaces that we're interested in. And then the second field season, we're going back with the laser scanner to get the details.
Next thing I want to ask you is about astrobiology. And
yes.
How can we transfer all these things we've learned about the acarabiota biology into this new emerging field of astrobiology? What's your plan? How do you plan to work together with people from other fields to understand this big question of life in the universe?
So I'm very, very interested in what the evolution of life would look like on other planets. So a lot of astrobiology has been focusing kind of on most of life on Earth, which is microbial life, and looking at, for example, how life could survive in extreme environments in order to kind of maximize our understanding of where we should be considering looking for life. But I'm interested in thinking about, to some extent, how astrobiology can help our understanding of evolution here on Earth. So almost the opposite, which is that if we find life in the form of biosignatures, for example, on lots of different planets, how would that compare to what we see on Earth? So if we have, as some people feel, we might end up in 10, 20 years' time with thousands of biosignatures, we can start to then compare that to what we would expect if life progressed as it did on Earth. So to me, it's really, really strange that we have over 3 billion years of life before we get animals. And to me, that raises a question, is like, did we get very unlucky here on Earth? Was it hard here on Earth for us to evolve animals? Or the alternative is, did we get really lucky and actually it's near impossible to get this sort of level of biological complexity we see. And as a result, you know, we're not going to find them anywhere else. And so when we, you know, fingers crossed, if we start to and when find life on other planets in the form of biosignatures by comparing the sort of biosignatures we're seeing and seeing how that compares to the sort of ecological complexities that we see here on Earth. So we have the different step changes. We have the life, but relatively low levels of oxygen. Then we have the step change with oxygenic photosynthesis, and we have the step change of when life populates land. By looking at this, we can start to try and figure out these kind of what is the fundamental nature of evolution. You know, is life everywhere just microbial, or actually, do we get really complex animal-like forms everywhere by looking at, for example, planets that are much older than us, and potentially younger than us, and seeing this kind of range of different ages of planets potentially corresponding to different, you know, points in time and evolutionary history.
Yeah, that's cool, because when you look at the sky, there are so many stars with different ages, and that means we're going to have planets with different ages. And
exactly, yes, yeah.
Nice snapshot. But I think Professor Andrew Davison made a good point about this. Once you detect something, then you want to see more.
Yes.
You need to wait until they build the next bigger telescope. And it would be nice to know what's the kind of geology inside this planet, the kind of what kind of rocks you have. That's going to be very difficult to do with the telescope.
Yeah, so you have different sorts of remote sensing. We're incredibly lucky that we have things like the Mars Perseverance that Professor Nick Tosca is involved with, that where we have this potential to bring back samples, but most of the time it's going to be remote detection. Yeah. So we're looking at things like the atmosphere and relative different levels of oxygen. We can detect water remotely, methane, and it really is a combination of lots of different sorts of molecules or chemistry like oxygen, methane, that really kind of implies life. And then by looking at the different levels, potentially, we can then try to work out what, you know, how complex the underlying biosphere is.
But so far, for the existing propulsion mechanisms that we have right now, there is no way we can get out of the solar system and send probes outside.
Well, we
can, but then we need to wait thousands of years before the...
Yes, yeah. So remote detection is definitely the best way forward, I think, at the moment.
Yeah. Right, the last question I want to ask you is the big question. The laws of biology universal.
Yes.
What do you think?
Well, what are the laws of biology? So, short answer, yes, but actually it's quite complicated, because I think a lot about what the kind of null models of evolution are. So we know evolution happens in Darwinian sense, you know, organisms adapt to their different surroundings and they will behave in a systematic way here on Earth. But, you know, what happens to kind of the broad scale patterns of evolution diversification? You can get a surprising amount, you can replicate a surprising amount of the kind of patterns of diversity through time that we get here on Earth, just using very simple models that don't take into account, that just, you know, say there's a probability a species turns into two species, there's a probability a species goes extinct. And using these sorts of birth-death models, we can actually replicate a huge amount of the patterns that we see. And if things are quite simple, then, you know, what is the simplest model? And, you know, how would that then replicate on different planets? And so I would say that the laws of biology are universal, but it's not really the same as in the way that the laws of physics are universal, because there's so much more that's unpredictable about biology, or messier, or not, maybe not unpredictable, but kind of noisier. There's a biological systems are a lot more complex. And so when we're thinking about life on other planets, if the entire planet is 2 degrees warmer, how will that affect evolution? If it's consistently just changed, or 2 degrees cooler, or if we have a lot more land mass or a lot more water. So these are things that I think will be subject generically to the same rules, but we don't necessarily know how those rules would apply in those circumstances.
Okay, Emily, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
And good luck with your new experiments.
Thank you.